Extravaganza named the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts, man. It's quite straightforward, self-explanatory, but unfortunately our guests always need explaining because oftentimes I've never talked to them before, haven't even so much as looked at their websites. I'm like Larry King live. I don't do research on my guests before I have them on. So what I do, the very first thing, is I ask them who they are and get them to introduce themselves. My guest today is Frank O'Collins. Frank, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Vinny.
So, postulate away and tell us all about you.
Well, I might put the postulating aside, but I'll get into it. Thank you. Look, my background is pretty varied. I've done a number of things in my life. I've spent time in a Capuchin seminary. I've worked for the Conservative Party of Australia, the Liberal Party. I've worked in finance. I've played rock and roll. So I've seen pretty much every side of life. And in between all those things, over a period of about 20 to 25 years, I started gathering snippets of ideas and spirituality and a journey. And in the last 15 years of that journey, I made a commitment that I would come to understand at least why we're here, why I'm here, what's the purpose of everything, is there a sense of chaos? And that personal journey ebbed into what we call Yucadia, yucadia.com, and the site Yucadia, and now the site One Heaven, and a number of other sites as well.
So you tried to figure out why you're here, have you?
Well, if I said yes, it sounds pretty arrogant, but I have a sense, yes, I have a sense of why I feel I am here, why we are all here, but that is a model. So really, rather than it being a fact, it turns out to be really just that, an idea, but part of a broader set of ideas, a framework.
Kind of like everybody's got an opinion on everything, and facts kind of trump opinions most of the time. But when it comes to spirituality and figuring out why I'm here and what I'm doing, often it comes up down to the opinion of the person. But in some cases, particularly religious sects and things of that nature, they say, no, it's not your choice about why you're here or anything. God's already predetermined it, and you don't have any free will in that, yeah, in that instance.
Exactly. Well, you've raised two really, really, I think, important issues. The first is the labels that are put on things that make it sound different, but really it's the same thing rehashed. And secondly, the idea of do we have a part to play in our own life? Do we have an influence on our own life, or are we cogs in a wheel or stuck on a train? And the thing I actually found, and the thing that's probably taken the longest, has been to dissect the labels. Everything's labeled. And you find that the labels today weren't the labels then. You find that the same thing is rehashed 100 times and it's the same wisdom. But it sounds sexier when it's quoted in Sanskrit than it is in English. Yeah.
Well, when an idea becomes old and forgotten about, when it returns, people think it's revolutionary.
Well, it does, and it can make money for people who are in the business of selling information or selling other people's ideas given freely. And you see that over and over again, the success of The Course of Miracles or the success of the book The Secret or the success of De Bono doing his stuff. People make a lot of money by claiming that they are the originator of the idea, and because there's so much information, a lot of people don't have time to read, so they wouldn't know that what they're selling was something that was promoted 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago.
And even if they did, people have really short memories these days, don't they?
Look, we're under attack. We're definitely under attack on all sides, whether it be through the food or whether it be through electromagnetic material. And honestly, I think people's attitude towards a lot of information is a bit like a triage of an emergency room. Just get the information you need and keep the filters up to protect yourself.
I feel kind of that people have sort of deprioritized themselves in favor of a collective, and that's very ironic because what's the collective made up of? Individuals!
Well, I would agree, if we're going to talk about popular culture, certainly I would say that in the last, certainly in the last 15, 20 years, there's been a deliberate deprogramming where people find their niche, find their tribe, if you like, but not necessarily have done the homework of themselves to ask, who am I? Why am I here? How does this all mean? And where maybe am I going?
Well, it's some people use that as sort of an excuse to have a rhetorical question like, oh, what can I do about it? It's you're actually supposed to try and answer that question, not just asking it into the wind, you douchebag.
Yeah, yes, I subscribe to the frustration, and I get this all the time. For example, when you write, as I've been involved in, looking at the foundation of law. So, as you know, many, many people are struggling with law. They're struggling with law all around the world. And one of the problems with law is the law is based on occult. In other words, it's based on deliberately hiding its truth, its foundation. So what we've been doing on one-heaven.org is been rebuilding a thing called the canons of law. So when people hear the word canon, they go, oh, canons, church, shut down, bang. And they hear the words one heaven, they go, oh, it's religious, I'm not going to deal with it, chunk. So I get this frustration all the time where people, because they don't read, because of being under attack, they easily come to a conclusion, or even they feel comfortable just accepting someone's summary, even if it's just a one-off line. I don't want to read it. I can't deal with it. If it's not on TV, it can't be true. And no matter how moronic that is, sadly, a lot of people, that's their acceptance. I won't read it because someone said it wasn't accurate.
Yeah, yeah. People really have got themselves in this sort of circular mindset where I'm too dumb to read and I'm not going to read because I'm too dumb sort of thing. And ultimately, when you're leading yourself around a garden path in a circle or whatever, you're actually doing that to yourself. Somebody else has provided you that garden path and provided you the circle, but you're the one who's chosen to walk it.
Well, I'll give you a classic example. The youth of today are well aware of the oppression of the courts. They're aware that the courts are hiding information from them. They're aware that the courts are dealing very much in an occult-type ritual. Yet at the same time, when someone openly states that here is the background knowledge to that, but you need to read the history because the law today didn't suddenly appear yesterday. It's an accumulation of hundreds of years of success. If you're not prepared to read that, and yet you stupidly, and I use this word, you're stupidly and moronically going to go to court believing what someone has just told you, which is go to court, say these words and click your heels and it's be true. No wonder so many young people are finding themselves with triple fines, with 60 days in jail and with far more serious matters because, as you said, they're in a state of mind where they are being too stupid to learn and too stupid to realise how they are pretty much throwing their lives away. And it's very, very frustrating for me because the matters of law is something that touches, well, pretty much everybody today.
But it's not their fault that they're stupid. You know, it's they virtually didn't have a chance, you know. There's so many things that are being done deliberately to dumb us all down, whether that be, well, basically taking all the nutrients out of our food supply so that we can't even develop our brains properly, teaching things like vaccines are good for you, vaccines are safe, vaccines are effective. No, 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 no. Mercury is not safe and effective. I'm sorry.
Yes, try dioxin for your plants. Get rid of all those nasty insects. Well, the traditional sheds, and I'm sure in New Zealand the same thing was the same, and I'm sure in America the man's shed was his cave in the 40s and 50s. And I remember going to my grandfather's shed when he passed away and finding all kinds of things that which I knew that if I touched with my own hands were deadly toxic. But I have to disagree with you on one point you raised, which is saying it's not their fault. I agree that education and the whole system has, certainly since the 60s, been deliberately designed to dumb people down. There's no question. What people learn at school today and how schools run today, by and large, is not a patch on the way education was at the peak in the 50s and the early 60s. But there is no excuse when someone reaches an age, say an age of 16, 17, 18, 19, where they're smart enough to know that the courts are a money-making machine, but they're arrogant and dumb enough to think that they don't need to learn. That's where I draw the line. If you're smart enough to realize that the courts are there to pretty much make money and grind you through, then you have no excuse if you then don't do the homework to be prepared. That's where I draw the line.
It's a strange thing, though, because normally people, before they become activated, they have to have something really bad happen to them, either at the hands of the state or at the hands of some criminal organization or whatever, before they sit up and realize, oh, my God, now, and have that impetus to actually do something. The most people are just simply dumbed down, mindless, television brainwashed, redundant protoplasm floating around in an ether sea, basically, with no comprehension of what this world they're really in actually is, because all of that information isn't given to them, you know. I mean, unless I had been arrested when I was 19 and been listening and been shown Bill Hicks by a friend of mine and a documentary called Truth of Lies of 9/11 by FromTheWilderness.com, Mike Rupert. Former CIA, Justice Department, that kind of thing. Unless somebody had introduced me to that, my mind wouldn't have even been open to it. And but had I been introduced to that information and chosen to do nothing with it, then I would agree with you that it would have been my fault, right? But again, there's the whole element of brainwashing and how people are brought up and public education and how they're repeatedly fed misinformation by the media that it's a very unfair fight. It's like telling a midget to go fight Hulk Hogan in the ring and then blaming him for losing.
All right. Well, let me then say, let's see if the time we have a chance over the next period, that I can share with you what I've been able to gather in terms of law and how that's helping people get out of that circle, that vicious circle we've been talking about, and how maybe in the few minutes, you know, we've got left, that I can share what I've been doing and how that information is directly relevant if people have problems of the law.
Sure.
Well, I mean, the first thing I'd say to someone that is facing a legal problem is answering the question, what is the law? Because if you go to a lawyer, if you want to annoy a lawyer, the first thing to annoy a lawyer is to ask the lawyer, well, what is the law? And I'll get most upset. But the reason I'll get most upset is to people who go to school and learn about the law, they're not taught actually what the law is, the history of the law. They're taught about procedure. So the first thing about the law is to realize that the law is, in fact, an accumulation of standards, norms, procedures, customs, maxims that have come from a range of sources, but most notably begin with the concept of religious law, that there is a faith, and that faith is managed by a group of priests of some denomination, and that they tell us through certain scripture and through certain doctrine that there are certain norms of life. So I might be Muslim, Christian, Jewish, Hindu, Buddhist, Jain. I might be any one of those. And all of those have the same theme. The law begins with the sacred law, the divine law, the law of a religious bent. And that is exactly what we have in the West. The root of all law, no matter whether it be a parking fine, a murder case, a civil challenge, statement of claim, all of it begins with Roman Western law, which is called canon law. Roman canon law. And the last time they updated it was in 1983. So that's the foundation of modern Western law today.
Well, I've always said that the establishment puts the awful back into lawful. And essentially, it just works as a system that people don't understand. You know, like you ask the average person, what's the law on traffic or whatever? Anything. And they don't know. They don't know what the justification for the law is. They don't know how it works. They don't know how it's applied. And so how could they have it consented to govern them? You know, that's my problem with it. We'll listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, my very special guest from Australia, the desert surrounded by alcoholics, Frank O'Collins, talking about spirituality and the law. And we'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
Fisticuffs, beware, or I will not be a prisoner. I will not be a slave. I will not behave, and I will fight you. Every single step you take, I will give you a kick in the face with my informational weaponry.
Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide. Hey, everybody's got to have fun, all right? Here's the great thing about psychopaths. They hate people making fun of them. They take themselves far, far too seriously. And we shouldn't take them seriously either. Because they're just a bunch of idiots. Because if they were smart, they'd realize that competition is far inferior to cooperation. Cooperation between good, decent people that we have in the truth movement is very, very strong indeed. Very good people all over the world have such incredible power, such strength, such knowledge that it would be a shame to waste it and to waste the opportunity to meet these people like Frank O'Collins from Australia. Frank, welcome back. And could you plug your website again?
Yeah, well, I won't plug it, but it's one-heaven.org is probably the best one to go to, the canons of law.
All right. Now, we wanted to talk about the creation of the canons. Go ahead.
Well, just we were speaking before, we were talking the frustration where people may find themselves in a circular state where they know they've got problems, they've got an issue, They might, as I say, have a parking fine, might have been arrested for something, might have some serious issue they have to deal with. They know the system is corrupt, but they haven't yet dived in enough to find out what is the law. So really their knowledge of the law might come from the forums, Facebook friends and others who may or may not really understand the essence of the law. So they can quickly, you can very quickly put yourself in a very, very dangerous position because you're going to court under-equipped without the knowledge and find that rather than simply having a fine tripled, people I've heard of time and time again have gone to court and ended up going to prison without ever realising what they were doing. The Bar Guild has been in power for over 800 years. The guilds originally come from Florence, and in fact the word art, A-R-T, comes from the art of law. It was the Medici who controlled Florence in the 13th century that gave us the guilds. And they had two types. They had the Arti Mediane, and they had the, there were seven of those, or five of those, I should say, and then there were seven minor, they called Arti Minori. The number one were the cloth and wool merchants, but number two was the notaries and judges, the Arte de Guidici e Notai, or the Guild of Judges and Notaries. So for 800 years, they've been in the business of privatizing the law, controlling the law, and making money off the law, unchallenged for 800 years.
I feel that if something's unchallenged for 800 years, there's got to be some kind of suppression going on to those who would compete with it, right?
There has not been, to my knowledge, a single credible threat to the Bar and Notary Guilds since its creation and then its upgrade in the 19th century to what we now know as the Bar Societies and the Bar Associations. There has not been a single credible threat other than people in positions of authority, such as the founding fathers in the United States, that actually had laws on the books preventing lawyers and the bar or the guild from having a role in government. But those laws were gradually phased out in the 19th century until by 1870, the bar was completely and totally in control of the law in America.
It kind of reminds me, the word guild, what it reminds me of is Dune, the spacing guild, who control everything in that particular universe. I think that's exactly what these people are trying to do here. They're trying to control our little universe.
Well, that's public notice. Everything out of Hollywood is public notice, hence the Matrix. The Matrix tells you, from a commercial sense, you're nothing more than a battery, a source of energy for the machine. So again, in the film Dune, they give you an insight into the monopolization of the world, and it's fair public notice. But the single thing that has caused the bar and caused the guilds to be in power for so long is that the occult art has never truly been exposed, and their power is knowledge. Their power is secret knowledge. For example, when you go to court, you'll hear the words all rise. People won't think about what those words mean. They might hear the word the court is now in session. People wouldn't ask themselves, well, what is session? Session was a word created by a group called the Carolingians and a fellow by the name of Charlemagne, very famous
character. I thought it was created by the Rastafarians.
Well, they've got their own words, but no, I don't think it was the Rastafarians. But the word session was the word in French used to describe an estate. So you hear the word estate when someone passes, you know, the deceased estate and so on. The word that the French used was session. So you're hearing a word in court associated with a group that created another form of law called sacred law, sacré loi. So all around you are signs, symbols, rituals, procedures by you standing there, you are actually not just agreeing to, but you're participating in these rituals. If you go to court and you have no idea what's going on, then you have no one to blame but yourself if you end up in prison, fined, or have nothing left.
Well, that's most of the case, right? Court, I think the only way to avoid the consequences of court is to just not show up. You know, you don't have to. They say, they give you a summons, you know. What am I, some demon that they're going to summon? I'm not going to court. I'm going to go fishing.
Well, the danger is, you know, I mentioned the word canon to you earlier, and I said that all law is based on canon law. And unfortunately, people think canon means religion. Actually, the word canon, when you look it up, merely means a rule, a bar, a norm, a maxim, or a measure, standard, that has been uncontested over time. So the word canon just means all those things, something that is uncontested, a pillar, a foundation. That's all the word means, a foundation. And one of the foundations of law from the beginning till today is silence or acquiescence is consent. In other words, if you don't respond to those documents, you consent. If you don't go to court, then you consent. And whilst there are dangers in not knowing actually what the summons is, there is just as much danger in not attending, because they treat that by law as you consenting, and therefore they can come after you, arrest you, and pretty much you have no chance then of defending yourself. Once you're arrested and it's dishonor, you've already lost. And so people that say, oh, I'm not going to go to court, very quickly a $500 fine goes into a $2,000 fine and a prison sentence. And it's happening over and over again. And they love you not to attend. They don't want you to attend. Why? They make more money off you. Why would they want you to attend court? They're happy for people to believe they shouldn't go. Why? Because they make the job easier for you. If you acquiesce your honour, you have no honour, they can come after you, they can triple, quadruple a fine, and in some cases they will put you in prison.
Yeah, well, and it comes down to the point where they don't obey their own laws, even though they're the ones who create them, so ergo they should probably abide by them, right? And because a summons is not actually technically something that you have to abide by if you're going to court charged with something that's like a legal fiction or whatever, it doesn't actually take away from the fact that they're criminal sociopaths running the show, and it doesn't matter if they're breaking the law, they just lie and kill and destroy anyway.
Sure, there's two things there that you say that are important to dissect. The first is, what is a summons? And yes, a summons is ultimately an invitation, but how does it come to you? Does it come to you on yellow paper? Does it come to you on pink paper? Does it come to you on blue paper? People might say, well, who cares what colour paper it comes to you on? Actually, it makes a huge difference what colour the paper comes to you on, because under the commercial laws of their system, for hundreds and hundreds of years, colour of paper means something. Yellow is the colour of receipt, a remittance, an acknowledgement, a duplicate copy. So if you receive something in yellow as a remittance and an acknowledgement, and you don't hand it back, then what have you just done if that is a piece of paper issuing claiming there's a charge against you? What have you just done? You've accepted the liability. So, yes, the summons might be an invitation that I decline, but they added to that by putting it on yellow paper. So here's where people are getting tricked up all the time. They're getting tricked up all the time because they're not seeing that as an occult, they're embedding multiple levels to it. Now, here's another thing. How does the laws of the world operate now? In the United Nations, since the United Nations was formed, and all these treaties of the United Nations have been put in place, we are now subject to laws such as the Geneva Convention and the Hague Convention. Now, sadly, most people have never read, even most people in the truth movement, have never read the Hague Conventions nor the Geneva Conventions, and they don't even really know what they are. What they are, as a law of nations, are effectively the laws of combat, the laws of war, the laws of two belligerent parties dealing with one another. So what's happening is we are interpreting that they are not following their own laws. That's actually not strictly correct. What's happening is we are failing to identify ourselves as a non-combatant, a peaceful non-combatant, or one of the only two roles that can declare immunity, being an ally of the Queen, an ally of the Commonwealth, or what's called an apostolic mendicant minister, basically a priest. We don't identify ourselves as either a role of immunity or a non-combatant, and they are using the rules of war against us, which they can. In other words, if someone stands up, what's public notice in the last 11 years? What is the theme of the last 11 years? What have we seen in 9/11 and George Bush and everything? What are we in the war on? We're on the war of what? The war on?
Terror.
Terror. Okay. And who are the terrorists?
Why don't we have a war on depression? Or a war on
poverty.
Why don't we have a war on Yetis and Sasquatches or some other kind of fictional character? You know.
Well, the public notice they gave us 11 years ago was that they were declaring war on the population as terrorists, right?
Yeah. So if you're a member of the public. Yep. You are a terrorist by very definition.
Correct.
Ironically enough, the definition of terrorism is it's actually a system of government whereby they make people afraid and force their compliance that way. Does your government sound like a terrorist government? Why, yes. Yes, in freaking deed it does. So if the government was having a war on terror, essentially, if they were telling the truth, which governments aren't exactly known for that, they'd be at war with themselves.
Sure. But we are the terrorists in the war on terror. Flat stick, as you said, we are the terrorists by definition since the war started. And what this allows them to do, because they've given public notice, is to enact the laws of warfare, the war on nations, the Hague Convention, the Geneva Convention, which allows them to circumvent the normal procedures of peacetime. So why do they do it and how's it working? Well, they did it because their system has become so unwieldy and so badly maintained, they couldn't keep going. In other words, they couldn't hold it together. What this allows them to do is to shortcut all the procedures that you see in statute. Once you declare yourself a belligerent, someone who stands up to the government, then you immediately identify yourself as a terrorist. If you write back and don't pay the fine, you have immediately identified yourself as a terrorist, as an enemy of the state, as a combatant. Once you do that, the government then can do whatever it wants.
Well, and even then, they do whatever they want anyway. Because if there's something that accountants aren't very good at, it's holding the government to account. Listen to the Vinny Eastwood Show. Very special guest is Frank O'Collins. And we'll be right back after the break with the VinnyEastwoodShow.com. Join us in the chat room there. Back in a minute.
The world we knew is gone. The conditions which framed and taught us our status have gone with us. Our needs are now different and our aims. The conditions which framed and taught us our status have gone with us.
The Vinny Eastwood Show, right here on American Freedom Radio, booking it down in the Schwarzenegger sense of the verb. at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. You can also join us in the chat room there. And I also wanted to make a plea out to the listeners. If you are capable of financially supporting the show in any way, shape, or form, whether that be by making it just a one-off donation or $5, $10 or something like that, or if you're willing to subscribe to do a recurring donation, whether that be $5 a month, $5 a week, whatever, please, please do so, because, well, quite frankly, the problem with our society nowadays is that it's the ultimate New World Order scumbags who can make money out of nothing that can finance their ultimate media domination, military, industrial, complex scumbaggery machines that we're up against. So, conveniently, we've operating our own little counter-scumbaggery machine here at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, where we depend quite literally on the interdependence of all the patriots and truthers who listen to the show, who send us guest suggestions. And I can assure you that about 90% of the guests that we have on this show are suggestions from you, the listeners. I don't set the bar very high. I don't have to have heard of them. I don't even have to look at their website. I just bring them on specifically because you, the listener, asked me to. And it's my duty to serve you, the listeners. This doesn't mean you have to contribute anything to the show. Doesn't mean you're not obligated in any way. I feel the one is the obligation because I don't want to be employed anymore. Basically, that's the ultimate thing is I don't want to have a job where somebody can tell me what to do all day, every day, whatever. I would rather instead be a volunteer and a slave to the people that I serve. And I get to choose how I contribute in every single way that I conceivably can. And it's an honor to do so. My very special guest is Frank O. Collins, coming us live from Australia. Now, we were talking about making it difficult for the New World Order and the legal system and all of that kind of stuff. How can people throw a monkey wrench in the works, Frank?
Well, they can certainly throw a monkey wrench in the works if they remember some absolutely fundamental rules whenever you're facing court. And those rules are, don't simply believe the mythology that people throw at you, like you don't have to go to court or fill in this piece of paperwork and it all goes away. When you go to court, there is indeed a way to become competent where effectively you can challenge a magistrate or indeed challenge a judge by the virtue of them now being government and corporate employees, that they no longer have the mandate or the warrant to hear cases and adjudicate cases as they claim. In other words, you can go to court and say, once you have established yourself in what's called the role of a general executor or administrator, you can go to court and say these words. I am, when the judge says, Frank O. Collins, you say, I'm here for that matter. They move forward and they say, are you Frank O. Collins? You say, I am the administrator under warrant appointed to represent that named party. In other words, you're saying to the judge that you have a warrant, you are the administrator, and you have the right to oversee those matters. The judge says, well, who are you? You say, I am the administrator appointed under warrant, and I have here a writ of quo warranto, and I ask you, whom do you serve? Do you serve the people, the Constitution, or do you just serve the corporation? In other words, show me the money. Are you a duly appointed judge or are you a corporate judge? And if they say, well, I've been appointed by the President of the United States or I've been appointed by the Constitution, you say, fine, I bind you to your oath as a fiduciary and am now happy to proceed to hear the issues of controversy that are raised. Because under fiduciary law, again, something I hope people go and see, they are obliged to serve your best interest. But as it stands,
because they're in a position of trust, and that's what fiduciary means. The problem is that often these people are untrustworthy and they simply put the douche back into fiduciary.
Correct, because they are agents. They're appointed as private contractors to serve the interests of whatever agency has the law named after it. So if it is a matter of tax, they are a private agent for the IRS. If they are there for transport, they're a private agent for transport and so on. So absolutely. So there's one example to show at the high end. The other example is this. People go to court thinking that they will throw everything and the kitchen sink at them and something will stick. You've heard that? Just wrap it all up, put it in a document, manifesto, throw it all at, and something's going to stick, right? The courts operate on a very simple principle. It's called reductio ad absurdum. In other words, if I can find a contradiction in your argument, I can move to have your entire argument thrown out. In other words, one weakness, and they can throw your entire defense out the door. How often have you heard?
That sounds very similar to, Albert Einstein saying that if one part of my theory is wrong, the whole theory is wrong.
Well, that's exactly how the legal system approaches arguments, and it works both ways. So if one goes to court with this thought in mind, because the law has become procedural, because the purpose of the law, the meaning of the law has become redundant, where they cut corners, and they cut corners all the time. They don't sign something, they don't seal it, they don't follow. If you read the procedures, then it's very easy to find dozens and dozens of things they failed to do because they're lazy now, because they're making so much money. One cause, one argument, one action. Find the biggest weakness in what they have done, if there is a technical flaw, and use their procedure to shut it down. That is something that anyone can do without having to be a master of speaking, a master of what I said before about being an administrator. Just look for those technical things they failed to do. And rather than throwing the kitchen sink at them, pick one thing only and make that the number one issue. So, for example, if it's a mortgage case, or it's a driving case, if there's a fundamental flaw, like they didn't sign a document, they didn't date a document, they didn't, I tell you one that's probably the most common now, people put a claim of facts in front of a case. If those facts have not been affirmed as being true, then they're hearsay. They're totally hearsay. In other words, when someone prepares a brief of facts, they actually have to swear that those facts are true, right? So if they don't put that in, then what do those facts become? They become hearsay, don't they? That is a fatal flaw that is present in almost 90% of cases now. Many, many cases. That's
especially murder cases. You know, you have a look at murder cases and you're like, how much evidence do you need to convict somebody of murder these days? Virtually nothing. All hearsay is all you need. And this person will go to jail for the rest of their life.
Well, there is a classic example of a fundamental flaw that is present so often around the world, it's not funny. Yet people fail to exploit it because when they write, they're told that they need to quote the Constitution, they need to put quotes of the Bible, they need to quote some free man movement, they need to quote X, Y, and Z, and they throw it all in there, and it's a smorgasbord for the lawyers. They look at this and say, oh, this is easy. Motion to strike. And even though the basis of your argument was true, you basically shot yourself in both feet. One argument, one cause, one argument, one action. Stick to the strongest thing and forget about the bloody kitchen sink. Yeah?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're gonna be taking out a cyclops, shove your spear straight through his eyeball. Don't worry about anything else because that's where he's vulnerable. That's where he will be taken out and that's where you will win. In the Odysseus sense of the word. Now, we've come to virtually the end of the line here, Frank. Is there anything else you'd like to mention before you go?
Super quick. When you get to issues of statements of claim against you and you want to write a counterclaim, remember a counterclaim must never reference their claim. It is merely a representation of the facts in your favour. That is another thing people fail over and over and over again. They write a counterclaim as a rebuttal of the other claim, and technically that renders it null. There's two very simple examples we've just said tonight of how people can slow things down and make it harder for them by being competent. That's the word, being competent.
Yeah, exactly. Competency is something that is very rare in government, but I find it's actually quite common amongst general, hardworking, decent people all over the world. And I suggest we use that to our best advantage, not only to make the other scumbags look really bad, but also to defeat them at their own corrupt, ridiculously scumbaggery game. And you can check out more of Franco Collins' stuff at one-heaven.org. That's one-heaven.org. Thank you very much, Frank, for coming on with me today. And coming up the next hour, ladies and gentlemen, we will be joined by Albert Burgess from the Uber Kingdom, talking about very similar stuff, who's actually arrested judges before in the UK. Very interesting. Good old Bobby on the beat. We'll be back right after the break. TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com. Ladies and gentlemen, to the fastest 2 hours in talk radio, the show that's all about erectile dysfunction. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide, because the world's so full of madness and chaos, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts, especially if you're coughing because you're smoking too much weed. My very special guest today is Albert Burgess, coming as live from the cacophony of chemtrailed Uber Kingdom. Albert, welcome to the program.
Hello there.
Yes. Can you, just for those listeners who may not be familiar with your work, could you just, you know, explain yourself again, I guess?
Well, basically, I'm English. I don't like what's happening with my country one little bit. I don't like what's happening around the Commonwealth one little bit. And I spent some time as a part-time volunteer police officer. And then a couple of years back, I was given some documents, which I was told were of historical interest. And I read them with my historian's hat on, because I like history a lot. And all of a sudden, I was wearing my policeman's hat, thinking, my God, this is sedition. And ever since then, I've been trying to get the police force in this country to actually go out and arrest the surviving members of Edward Heath's government and put them on trial for a conspiracy to subvert the Constitution, the major crime of sedition, and at that level of sedition, an act of high treason, and to hand this country over to a foreign power, the EEC, an act of high treason in its own right. But unfortunately, our police officers don't seem to recognise the crime of treason anymore.
Well, I probably say that's because they're all committing it, and it's kind of like when you're already in the pool, you don't know what being wet feels like anymore.
No, and I think the main problem is that for some time now, the English police force certainly has been using people who are graduates, university graduates, and they would join with a university degree, and they do 2 years on the beat and immediately get promoted to inspector, and then within 4 years they're a chief inspector, but they have actually got no real idea of what being a policeman on the beat is all about. And so they lose track with the rank and file officers, and they get accelerated promotion all the way up the ladder. So that what they are is basically they are not police officers, they're administrators. And like all administrators, they do what the person who pays their wages tells them to do, and of course that is the government.
It's the bureaucratic mindset where you're not capable of thinking, but you're certainly capable of following orders.
Well, absolutely, and I think that the if you look around our police force, in fact, you look around our judiciary, and you will find that there is very little knowledge in the police force of constitutional law or common law. They're very expert. Their expertise lies in annoying the motorist and giving him fixed penalty tickets all over the place. And basically, you know, generally speaking, making themselves unpopular. Whereas, in fact, they should be here to uphold the law as it is written, and that is all of the law. And nobody in this country, at least in theory, is above the law. So they should be able to go out and arrest the Prime Minister of the day, who is due for arresting, who's overdue for arresting, because every Prime Minister since Edward Heath has been in favour of the European Union, and that is illegal under our constitution.
When was Edwin Heath the Prime Minister?
Pardon?
When was Edwin Heath the Prime Minister?
In the early 70s. I think he...
Before Thatcher.
Yeah, he was... definitely. He in fact, Thatcher came after Heath as leader of the Conservative Party. And Heath, who I did meet personally, I mean, I'm a French polisher by trade, and I worked in his house in Chelsea that he had, and I found that Edward Heath was the most obnoxious individual. He would come in the morning to the house with all of the builders there. They would all stand up as he walked past them and say, "Good morning, Mr. Heath," and he'd stick his nose in the air and completely ignore them.
What a douchebag!
Yeah. Then he would go and sit at a desk, which he would pick up a sheet of paper and he would study it for 20 minutes. Then he would pull out a pad and he would write a note in a pad, put it in his pocket, and then he would get up and he would walk out again. Absolutely. I actually was working next to his desk for quite a few days doing French polishing of the woodwork that was there. And in point of fact, he always picked up exactly the same piece of paper every single day. It was just done for effect. Look at me, look how great I am, you know. It was just effect. The man, to my estimation... The man was, well, he was an obnoxious pig as far as I'm concerned.
Sounds somewhat retarded and self-obsessed. He sounds like a self-obsessed, moronic douchebag to me.
Well, that's correct. And I mean, that's my assessment of him. And he thought he knew better than the rest of the British people and the English constitution. And he is the one that sold this country to the European Union for £60,000.
In other words, he just put the con back into constitution, right? Sell everybody out. Hey, absolutely. And incidentally, you say £60,000? What do you mean by that? Did he get some description of payoff?
When he signed us up to the European Union, when he signed the Treaty of Rome, they gave him what they call a Charlemagne Award, which was a cash payment of £60,000 for being politician of Europe.
Like a charlatan award?
Europe. Well, in 1972, 73, £60,000 was a lot of money. Basically, he did this, and his boat had sunk. He had a nice big sailing yacht, which sank at its moorings. Part of the reason that for giving him the money was so he could buy a new boat, but his boat would have been insured anyway. So, you know, he would have claimed his boat on the insurance.
See, these people, why is it that people still vote for these guys? And I've come to the conclusion it's because they know nothing about them. If anybody knew anything about any of the politicians, none of them would receive a single vote. Except, of course, by a very small, determined minority of psychopathic scum.
Well, the thing is that most people will vote for a political party rather than an individual politician. my mum and dad would have voted Labour. And that wouldn't have made any difference if Satan himself had come and stood as a Labour candidate. They would have voted Labour. So, and a lot of people will always vote Tory. Where I live in Henley, in Henley constituency, you could put a chimpanzee up as a Tory party candidate, and the chimpanzee would be elected purely and simply because he's a Tory party candidate.
Well, what say it hasn't already happened?
Well, I've no idea, but I think we might try running a chimpanzee. You know? But
yeah, what's your policy on education?
Well, exactly. But then you see, there's not a lot of difference between the chimpanzee and the man we've got now, because you talk to the man we've got now, and he just says, "I'm the Member of Parliament. I'm here now. I will do what I like."
He's got slightly less hair and better clothes. That's about it.
Yeah, and you say to him, "Well, no, that's not the system. The system is we vote you in to represent our interests." And he says, "Well, you may have voted me in for that, but nevertheless, I'm going to do exactly what I want." And that's exactly what members of parliament do. And we have people writing to members of parliament all over the country. In fact, we've had some big mail shots go out to members of parliament where every member of parliament has been emailed by the same person. And, you know, we've got 635 MPs, and he will get 634 replies back saying, "I'm not your member of parliament. Take this up with him. I'm forwarding it to your member of parliament," which is, I mean, it's great as far as you're concerned if you want to annoy your member of parliament, because he gets the full 635 letters. But it doesn't actually do anything. And when you go back to them and say, "Hold on a minute, what I'm writing to you about is not a constituency issue. This is an issue of which affects the entire country. So it's a national issue, and you are required to look after the national interest, not just your constituency, but the national interest as a whole." And of course, they then balk at that, and they start getting all uppity, and then they tell you they won't answer your letters anymore. So, and
but
it's
of course,
the same.
They're just as likely to read your letters as they are to read the legislation that they pass, which is not very.
Well, absolutely. But if they read it and the points that are being made in these letters are good, because I get a lot of them sent to me and say, "What do you think of this, Albert?" And then I say, "Well, I think that's brilliant there." And then they send it off. What they're supposed to do is look at it and see that the points in the letter are good and that they affect the country as a whole, not just their constituency. And then because they have this interest in the national interest, if you like, then they are required to deal with the national interest points that you're making. But they don't do it. They simply refuse to do it. And it's like our police force. We have a law over here now called the 2002 Police Reform Act. And whereas before, when I joined the police force in 1986, if somebody came up to you and said, "Officer, officer, I've been burgled," or "Officer, officer, somebody's nicked a broken the wing mirror off my car," you would record that as a crime. But now the 2002 Police Reform Act gives them a lot of things they don't have to record as crime. So they simply say, "No, I'm not recording this as crime. You're not getting a crime book number, and it's not a crime." Because the 2002 Police Reform Act says we don't have to have it as a crime. But
have you noticed how that's how the law is actually used? Basically, what they do is they make crimes legal so that they can continue to break the law.
Well, absolutely. But, you know that you've had your car vandalized and the wing mirror's been ripped off of it. You know that, and you know that criminal damage to your car is a crime. You try and get a policeman to acknowledge that fact in this country today, and you can't. On the other hand, if you turn left where you shouldn't, they're going to stop you and they're going to throw a book at you because, you know, it's easy pickings, isn't it? Why stand out in a doorway in plain clothes all night long, wait for somebody to come down the road and rip car mirrors off so you can arrest them, when you can just stand there for a couple of hours and do the thing? And the other thing that they brought in when I was policing was they brought in a point system. So if you gave out a fixed penalty ticket, you'd get a point. If you gave out an endorsable fixed penalty ticket, you got 3 points. if you arrested a rapist or a murderer or a serial burglar, you got 3 points. But, you know, anybody can stand the wrong side of a set of traffic lights and stop cars that go through the red light and give them a an endorsable fixed penalty ticket and collect their 3 points. You have to work. If you want to catch a rapist or a burglar or a murderer, you actually have to investigate that. You have to work at it to get the evidence to prosecute them. And, of course, even after you've done all of your work, which can go on in the case of a murder or something like that, can go on for weeks or months, you still only get 3 points. And as your promotion depends upon how many points you've got by the end of the year, the man who stood there and just stuck on motorists and given them fixed penalty tickets like they're confetti gets infinitely more points than the detective who arrests the murderer or the rapist. So
basically, through the incentive process, it incentivizes treating the people like sheep and slaves and treating the criminals like something not worth bothering about.
Well, it would seem like that, yes. I mean, that is the opinion that a lot of people in this country have, and I don't believe that it's only in this country either.
No, same here in New Zealand, Albert. I feel like a slave whenever cop talks.
I think there's this organisation called Common Purpose, which has gone worldwide, where they train people in management, but what they're actually training them in is how not to manage, how to disrupt, and how to avoid doing the job properly.
Now, in the start of this, you mentioned the word sedition. Can you actually define sedition for me?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you've probably had Brian Gerrish on, haven't you?
Rings a bell.
Yeah, I think you may have had Brian Gerrish on. He talks about common purpose a lot. And one of the things that's occurring a lot in this country is that if a child comes to the attention of the social services, and I'll give you an example. A lady was walking her 3 children in a park, which is good for them, and it's good for their health and education and everything else. And 2 boys on a stolen motorcycle deliberately ran over her 4-year-old. Now, the boys were arrested, charged, and convicted with theft of the motorcycle and the injuries to her son. But her son was taken with a compound fracture of his leg to the hospital, and a cut down to the bone on his head. Now, he's a 4-year-old child, and they left him on a trolley for 28 hours. So the mother asked, why isn't he being seen by a doctor? And 2 nurses reported the mother as being abusive and a risk to the child. Now, the police came along, placed a police protection order on all of her children, and, of course, one of them's in hospital, so he can't go anywhere. But they arranged for his natural father, from whom she'd divorced because he'd gone over the side. He was in the Navy, and he went over the side with a friend he knew, and they were now living in Wales. So the police arranged for the father to take the older child with a broken leg. But the 2 younger ones were taken off the mother and put up for adoption. Now, this gets really, really good, because the 2 nurses, one was a nurse, Kofi, and the other was a Sister Wilson. And Sister Wilson had learnt nurse Kofi and her boyfriend, who was a heroin addict, a lot of money. And basically, you know...
Oh, we're coming up to break now. In fact, you just hold that thought there, Albert. We'll be back in a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. Join us in the chat room there. It'll be very nice to have you, and we'll be right back in just a minute. The way it's going to be. Gentlemen, to the show that's about having nowhere to run and nowhere to hide, there is only resistance. It is the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from New Zealand, live from the future. For those of you stuck on the other end of the dateline, don't worry, I'm sure you'll catch up eventually. From the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island-chained nation and the sunny slave South Pacific. And there really is no place to hide from a new world order, is there? And conveniently, though, humanity has naturally, I believe, adopted the tactic of the cactus. Covered itself in patriotic spines the world over. So every time a eugenicist, New World Order, corrupt, seditious scumbag places his foot in your nation, they get a little prick to remind them to F off. Like Albert Burgess, who's doing it in the Uber Kingdom. Albert, welcome back. We were talking about two nurses, one of which named Kofi.
Yeah. Sister Wilson and Nurse Kofi. Now, Sister Wilson lent Nurse Kofi a lot of money, and Nurse Kofi's boyfriend was a heroin addict, which, you know, implies there was more than just a professional relationship between the two of them, because no right-thinking nurse would lend money to a heroin addict because she knows she's not going to get it back. Anyway, what happened was that the heroin addict was then, and these two nurses were the ones who gave evidence against the mother. The heroin addict had spent the money that she'd lent them, and he went round to Sister Wilson's house and asked her to lend him more, and she refused. So he tied her up and he tortured her and got all of her card numbers out of her. He then murdered her. He then lived in her house for 2 weeks while he emptied her bank accounts and sold everything worth selling. And then he was caught shoplifting, at which point he told the police that he'd been kidnapped with this nurse by some Rastafarian drug dealers. And,
of course.
Absolutely. And that the nurse was still there, but he'd managed to escape. Quite how he explained not phoning the police as soon as he escaped, I don't know, but he was subsequently charged with her murder and sentenced to 25 years in prison. Now, obviously, Sister Wilson is no longer available as a witness against the mother, and Nurse Kofi has to be a very dodgy witness to have against the mother, because her boyfriend, a heroin addict, has been out and committed murder from the nurse that she borrowed all the money off of. So, I mean, they do not make credible witnesses. However, the mother fought a long and drawn-out campaign through the courts to get her children back, and eventually the judge in a court case, and I've seen the papers from the court case, that he said that there was nothing to prove that the mother had done anything other than be a perfectly good mother to the children. They were meeting all their parameters. They were well-dressed, well-fed. They were healthy. They were intelligent. But that they were putting the two youngest ones up for adoption on the basis that if they gave them back to the mother, social services would want an overview, and they were frightened that the mother might upset social services. So rather than upset social services, they took two well-looked-after, well-loved, in fact, three well-looked-after, well-loved, well-cared-for children off of a loving, caring mother and put the lot up for adoption. And when the mother was driving down the road and she saw the oldest boy when he was 12, she was driving down the road, she saw him, so she stopped and took him off and bought some sweets and stuff for him while she had a chat with her 12-year-old, and she was then subsequently arrested by the police for breaching the court order for approaching her son. You know, the system has gone tits up big time in this country. And it's all down to common purpose. It's down to complete and utter lack of regard for the law or people's rights. And that's what we're fighting to try and get over. I mean, I want my country back so that we can get it ruled under the rule of law. But in fact, that's not happening at the moment. And Parliament are passing law on a daily basis, or they're accepting European law on a daily basis, which actually is not only damaging our ancient rights and freedoms, but it's actually damaging the way the country operates.
I was on a I was on with Patrick Lynch from the Free Truth Radio show earlier, Albert, and I think I want to get you on there too, but I was asking him, he's from Bournemouth, and I asked him, can you think of a single law that's been passed in your country in your lifetime that's actually benefited the country?
And?
Can you?
Well, I can't, because the rules that they're... If you look at our common law and our constitutional law, and up until 1972, our statute law, they were all based on the Bible. And they were all very good, sensible laws. But after 1972, when we got into Europe, we got stuff which came in which has been very destructive of our industry, because they've imposed so many regulations on our industry that the industry has not been able to succeed. We had a law in this country called the Act of Provisors of 1351, and that made it a criminal offence akin to treason to actually dispose of any English asset to a foreign buyer. Well, in 1948, in the Criminal Law Revision Act, the Labour government of the day actually repealed that law. And we had another law, the Acta Promemoria of 1351, which made it a criminal offence akin to treason to import any foreign law into this country, or to draw anybody out of this country to be tried in a foreign court. And for any of the bishops to excommunicate any of the subjects of the king on the orders of the Pope. And these were acts of treason, and these two laws were brought in because the king considered that for these things to be happening was an affront to his honour and dignity as King of England. Well, now the second law, the Premenieri, was repealed by Harold Wilson's government in 1967 in the Criminal Law Act. And then Ted Heath signed us up to the European Union in 1972, 6 years later. And the first thing that happens is that we lost our fishing grounds, which is an asset of the country's. We've lost our steel-making industry. Our coal industry has been put out of business. If you look at anything at all, our car industry is gone. Our shipbuilding industry is gone. Our merchant navy is gone. Our aircraft industry has been decimated.
The only thing that's still there is the illegal drugs trade.
Well, yeah, that's the only profit-making industry in the country, actually, illegal drugs. And if you look at it, the restrictions placed upon our farmers, where they're paid not to grow food but to look after hedgerows, is ludicrous, because the farmers, because they wanted to keep the cattle out of their fields with the crops in, they would grow the hedgerows and look after them for themselves anyway, for their own benefit. So either grow hedges or you've got to build walls everywhere. And the hedges are easier to maintain. So, the whole thing is completely ludicrous. It's all down to the European Union, which we would not be in if Edward Heath hadn't set up his conspiracies to subvert the Constitution and to hand this country over to a foreign power, both of the acts of high treason.
Well, I have the doubts that he's the progenitor of those ideas, Albert. I think he's more just a puppet working for people of much higher intelligence, much higher power, more devious scumbaggery.
I'm sure this is true, and in fact, Macmillan, I think it was Macmillan that Heath worked for as a government minister. Macmillan wanted us into Europe before Heath was prime minister, and he was Macmillan's minister who was negotiating with Europe. It was his ambition to actually get us into Europe at any price. And in fact, our chief negotiator, Sir Con O'Neill, was ordered by Edward Heath not to negotiate, but to just accept whatever the French offered him. And he coined the phrase, swallow it whole and swallow it now. So that was that. But
What is he, a politician or a porn director?
Well, he was a civil servant, actually.
He was providing somebody a good service, wasn't he?
Well, he may well have had a somewhat liberal education, let's put it like that. you know, I mean, these are the things which are provable. They are documented. We have the documents on them. And we have everything else. But if you take something like John Major, who went and signed Maastricht and then came back and said the Queen is now a citizen of Europe, well, that is an act of treason. And we have law on that because in 1213, King John, who nobody liked and they wanted to kill him because he was abusing the wives and daughters of the barons, so all the barons wanted him dead, and he was suppressing the entire population with foreign mercenaries, so the population wanted him dead. He surrendered England to the Pope because he wanted the papal protection for himself. And he took on the mantle of a crusader so that if anybody tried to kill him, they would be excommunicated. And basically, they wanted him dead. But when John died in 1216 and his son came to the throne, he was only 9 years of age, Henry III, one of the barons who'd worked with John was made his guardian, and that was the Earl of Pembroke. And as soon as Edward III reached his majority, which probably say it was 20 or something like that, and was able to rule in his own right, the first thing he did was he placed the half a dozen barons and two bishops who'd helped his father surrender England to the Pope and put them on trial for treason. And he then wrote to the Pope and told him he wasn't getting any more money, and in all things ecclesiastical and spiritual, Edward III answered to God for the ecclesiastical things and his people for his spiritual things. So we had that. Then in 1366, the then Pope wrote to Edward III and said to him that he wanted this unpaid money from what Henry III had stopped paying it, which was about 160 years earlier. So Edward III didn't know anything about this, so he spoke to the bishops, they spoke to the barons, and then they went off and they spoke to the commons. And the following day they all came back, first the bishops, then the barons, then the commons, and they all told him the same thing. England did not belong to King John. He only held it in trust for those that followed on. Therefore, it wasn't his to give away. Therefore, the money wasn't owed, and he's not a vassal king to Rome. So Edward III dutifully wrote a nice letter to the Pope, telling him to go paint his face yellow and hide it in the corner somewhere. And so we now have evidence, and we now have case law, because this is parliamentary case law, that our kings and queens can never be vassal kings to anybody else because they don't have the right to give away the kingdom. Therefore, when John Major went to Maastricht and said the Queen is now a citizen of Europe, he was trying to make her a vassal queen to Brussels. And that, in fact, is an act of high treason. And we actually have somebody I sent the stuff off to today who's prepared, actually, to go and report John Major to the police for treason over Maastricht. We've had
in this day and age, people think the treason doesn't exist. I'm feeding back really bad through your thing there. People nowadays, they think that treason doesn't exist, kind of thing, when the reality is it's actually happening all the time, isn't it?
Well, it's happening all the time. It's happening with greater frequency. It is still fully on the statute books. If you get hold of a good law book, it will deal with treason and it will deal with sedition. Sedition, they tell me they've repealed, but then other law books, after they tell me it was repealed, talk about sedition. But treason is still there. But it no longer is on the syllabus at university for teaching lawyers. They don't get questioned on it. They don't have to know about treason or sedition, and it's no longer taught to police officers. Now, I joined in 1986, and I had a book called Moriarty's Police Law, which is an excellent book on police law. I don't think anybody could ever beat Moriarty's. And that dealt with all the offences against the state and what the policeman's role in dealing with them was. But none of the police law books that replaced Moriarty's have dealt with treason or sedition in any way, shape or form. So since 1986, our police officers have not been taught that treason is a crime. So when you say to a policeman, I want to report treason, he looks at you as though you're some lunatic from Mars, because, you know, what is treason? He's never heard of it, he doesn't know about it or do anything else about it. But it's basically, it's a destruction of the country, isn't it? It's more serious than murder, because you go out and you murder one or two people, but what this is talking about is the murder of an entire country.
We're talking about kind of like a rebirth, a new renaissance that is now coming into view, I feel. Everybody in the world has a part to play in this global revolution. It doesn't have to be a revolution where blood is spilled, but it is certainly a revolution where people need to throw out that which is treasonous, seditious, and scumbaggery. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Albert Burgess, and we'll be right back after the break. Jamming. I really do. Jamming a big monkey wrench into the unlawful scumbaggery that we all happen to live under, called the New World Order. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is fun to mess with your enemies. I can assure you. You do one thing every day that scares you, and by goodness, will you have a very enjoyable life. Especially if you have something called self-respect. When you go after scumbags who are destroying your country, acting treasonously, and sometimes you'll even wind up converting a few of those people who are actually supporting the system and can help to bring it down, because ultimately, it's either the system that's going to be brought down or us. Albert Burgess is my guest. You talked about your book that you've written, the Layman's...
Yeah, I've written a book. It's called A Layman's Guide to the English Constitution, and it traces the English Constitution from Alfred the Great up until to date. And it gives all of the major laws, which are constitutional laws, such as Magna Carta, the Charter of Liberties, Magna Carta, the Petition of Right, the Grand Remonstrance, the Bill of Rights of 1689, and so on, along with some of the other laws, the Acts of Provisos, Promenio, and the Act of Supremacy of 1559. It does all the major laws. And then it outlines the crimes committed against the Constitution by government. And we've now traced the beginnings of a power grab by the House of Commons in England back to 1661, when they first told the House of Lords that they could not amend the money bill. And as a direct result of that, the House of Lords had a little fight about it at the time, and then they gave way on that and decided they wouldn't amend the money bill. But as a direct result of that, in 1909, they put a budget through, Asquith put a budget through, and in his budget there was a plan for a pension for the working man. Now, that's a good idea, and you can't argue with that. However, the House of Lords looked at it, and they are major employers around the country because they all run big estates and everything else, so they know exactly what the working man is getting and exactly what he's paying in tax already. And they looked at it, and they decided that the extra tax on top of what he was already paying to pay for the pension was more than the working man could stand. So they not believing that they could amend the money bill and reduce the amount of tax that he had to pay to do it, and possibly the amount of pension he got, they actually rejected the bill. As a direct result of that, Asquith went back to them and told him he was putting through a bill that was going to reduce their powers and stop them being able to reject a law. They can only hold it up for a three-year period. The Lords said, well, they weren't going to agree to that. And then Asquith said, well, if you don't agree, I'm going to put 500 new peers into the House, and they will vote the House out of business. So the Lords caved in. I mean, if it had been me, if I'd been in the House of Lords, I'd have said, come on, lads, we're all off down to Buckhouse, and we'd have picked the King up by the nuts and said, you're not going to sign these letters patent when you get them put in front of you. And in fact, they wouldn't have needed to do that anyway, because what happened was they caved in, they gave it their consent, and it went to the King, King Edward VII, and King Edward VII said to Asquith, I'm not signing this, it's unconstitutional, and it removes a protection from my subjects. Well, shortly after that, he fell ill and died. I did write to the Commissioner of Metropolitan Police and tell him I'd be very interested in the toxicology on Edward VII, because we do know that King George V, when he died, his death was hastened by his doctor injecting him with a load of drugs that he shouldn't have been given. So King George V was actually murdered by the doctor. And we know that because the doctor's now said so, but he's dead anyway, so we can't hang him. But, I mean...
Guess him and Michael Jackson have got something in common then.
Yeah, yeah. So basically...
Well, as well as... Did you know, Albert, that the health service is like the third leading cause of death in New Zealand?
well, very likely, very likely. So when the King died, George V came to the throne... he was told he had no option but to grant the authority, the royal assent for this bill. And he was also told that although he keeps all of his prerogatives, he can't use any of them unless he has the backing of a government minister, which in fact means he doesn't have any. Because no government minister is going to put a bill through Parliament and then tell the King that he doesn't have to accept it and give it the royal assent, does he? I mean, it's just common sense. He's not going to do that. So... In one fell swoop, Asquith neutered the House of Lords in the ability to do its job, and he stole the royal prerogative. Now, when you neuter the House of Lords like that, that is to subvert the constitutional makeup of Parliament, and it's interfering in the cognizance of the House of Lords to run its own business, which is a common law thing. And in fact constitutes the act of treason by destroying the constitutional makeup of Parliament. And when you actually take the Queen's or the King's powers away from them and say you can only use these if we say you can, well, that in fact is also an act of treason, because you're actually restraining what the King can and can't do, and that's highly illegal. But Asquith got away with that. Then in 1949, they brought in the other Parliament Act, which said that they can't... hold up a bill for more than 1 year. So now they're in a situation where the House of Lords basically they can't hold it up for more than a year. There's no point in not voting in favour of it, is there? Because you know you can't stop it and whatever. So they've completely stymied the power of the House of Lords to do the job it was given by our forefathers to do, which is to vet legislation and do that. Now in 1999, Tony Blair. Who's definitely one we've got to hang. And if we can't get close enough to hang him, we've got to shoot him. But basically, Tony Blair put the 1999 House of Lords Act through, which threw all of the hereditary peers out of the House of Lords. Now, every hereditary peer has what they call a letters patent. And each letters patent tells the hereditary peer that he gives a job description of what it is to be a hereditary peer. And that is that he is to sit in the House of Parliament and vet legislation going through Parliament so that only that legislation which benefits the subject and the country gets through, and that he is to act as an advisor to the King or the Queen. That's what it actually says. I've actually seen letters patent. That's what it actually says. Now, by throwing them out of the House of Parliament, Tony Blair and his cabinet have actually put themselves in a higher position than Queen Elizabeth II and overridden her order to the hereditary peers to sit in Parliament and vet legislation and advise her. That is an act of high treason. But this is going on. Now, we have a lord in England, a man called Lord Merriworth. Now, his father had a seat in the House, but his father didn't die till he was 100. So Lord Merriworth had lost the seat when his father was actually one of the peers that was thrown out by Tony Blair. So Lord Merriworth wants a writ of summons to get into the House of Lords and do his job, which is to scrutinise legislation on behalf of the sovereign and to act as an advisor to the Queen. Doesn't want money for it, doesn't want to get paid for it. He just wants to do the job that he sees it is his job to do as the holders of a letters patent. He took a court case, which was dealt with by Judge Lewison, and Judge Lewison chucked his court case out. Now, in one respect, I understand why he did it, because the barrister that Lord Merriworth had was not up to the job. But on the other hand, of course, he did chuck it out. So I wrote to Lord Lewison, and I pointed out to him that because the ruling that he had taken, that Lord Merriworth should not, in fact, get a letters patent to go and sit in the House and do the job that his letters patent, a writ of summons to go and sit in the House so to do the job his letters patent from the Queen give him to do, then, in fact, he'd put himself above the Queen and nullified the Queen's direct lawful order to Lord Merriworth, and that was an act of treason. And I got a letter back telling me that it's against protocol to actually write to a judge about a case that he has heard, but that the judge had seen my letter and had ordered that it be placed on file without any comment. So I then said, I wrote back to them, and I said, well, look, your protocol is your protocol. I am a free-born Englishman, and I have an absolute constitutional right to say what I like, when I like, how I like, to who I like, provided I don't break the law by impacting adversely on them. So you can take your protocol and go and do the other thing with it, to which I didn't obviously get a reply. But what I would ask is, because this is something that, which affects all of us, it certainly affects the Commonwealth countries as much as it does us, because it affects the Queen. So what I'm going to ask is, we need to get this back working again.
I've always said that basically the problem with our society is that the truths that we think should be truths, you know, like truth, justice, the English way, or whatever, they've all become lies, really. You know, it's just total deception. And in order to make things right again, all you got to do is turn those lies back into the truths that they originally stood for by standing up and just saying, no, I'm not going to accept the lies anymore.
Well,
so thank you, Albert, for coming on the show with me today. Do you have a website you can plug? Just quickly.
Yeah, what's that?
Yeah, do you have a website?
Do I have a website? Yes, it's www.acasefortreason.org.uk.
All right, that's where we'll have to leave it. Thank you, Albert, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Please subscribe if you can at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. See you again sometime.